I want to thank David for such an outstanding introduction to the same basic topic that I'm going to be discussing. And I also want to thank my collaborators, Vern Barger, Haisong Lee, Dan Marfatia, and Jim Neller, who did most of the heavy lifting in this work, and the KITP, because this collaboration wouldn't have happened, I can say with certainty, if Vern and Danny and I weren't here being hosted by the KITP. So this work is really an outgrowth of this Neutrinos program. And what I want to do is to basically cover some of the same territory that that David did. And I want to emphasize the connections, possible connections, with neutrinos. So this used to be obligatory in any Big Bang nuclear synthesis talk, a plot of the predicted abundances versus this parameter that David introduced already, the nucleon to photon ratio, eta, measured in units of 10 to the 10 because it's really a very small number, somewhere between 10 to the minus 10 and 10 to the minus 9. So by multiplying by 10 to the 10, you get a convenient scale. Notice the abundances cover some 10 orders of magnitude, from the helium mass fraction in red, deuterium and helium 3, down to lithium 7. And they have different shapes, which means that they're independent ways of measuring potentially the same quantity. I point out, you notice some bands here. Those are the predicted uncertainties due to whatever residual uncertainties there are in the nuclear and weak interaction rates. The helium abundance also has a band, but that's so small, I don't think you can see it unless you have much younger eyes than mine. Notice that deuterium, helium-3, and lithium-7 have interesting variations with the baryon density. So they are potential probes of the baryon density. That is, the final abundances are limited by the competition between the nuclear reaction rates, production or destruction or both, and the expansion rate of the universe. And therefore, since the reaction rates depend upon the nucleon density, they are potential probes of the baryon density. They're potential baryometers. Very shortly, I will agree with David that the best probe is really deuterium, although the others may play some useful roles. And once again, to get the notation, eta is the nucleon to photon ratio. Eta sub 10 is that number multiplied by 10 to the 10. If you prefer omega BH squared, the conversion factor is 274. You might think I could put many other significant figures there, but I can't because the gravitational constant isn't known accurately enough. So if anyone tells you this conversion with more than three significant figures, he's cheating. Now, in contrast to deuterium, helium-3, and lithium-7, the helium-4 mass fraction, usually denoted by capital Y, is not rate limited. That is, once nuclear reactions begin in the early universe, deuterium, helium-3, tritium very quickly get burned to helium-4. And it's so fast that it's not rate limited. There is, of course, a gap at mass 5. So everything gets stuck at helium-4. Only occasionally can you jump the gap and go up to mass 7. Then there's another gap at mass 8, no stable nucleus there. And that's why you don't make the heavy elements in standard Big Bang nuclear synthesis. The helium-4 abundance is, in fact, limited by the neutron-to-proton ratio, because since the neutron's heavier than the proton, there are always fewer neutrons than protons. Once you use up all the neutrons, you can't make any more helium-4. The neutron-to-proton ratio is determined by the competition between the weak interaction rates and the expansion rate. And so the helium mass fraction is sensitive to the expansion rate, since we know the neutron lifetime and therefore the strength of the beta decay type reactions and the scatterings of electrons, positrons, neutrinos with neutrons and protons. We know that very well. So the helium-4 mass fraction provides a measure of the early universe expansion rate, how fast the universe is expanding when the temperature and density were ideal for nucleosynthesis. And what we're going to see, as David already mentioned, is we can compare this to the expansion rate of the universe when the cosmic background radiation was formed, some 380,000 years later. And to anticipate some of the conclusions, which I'm sure you all know, the agreement between the two is spectacular, confirming our general picture that we understand, generally speaking, the evolution of the universe from the first few minutes to several hundred thousand years later. Actually, what is important is this expansion rate factor or speed up factor. Oh, H wasn't chosen at random, that's also the Hubble parameter. You're used to the current value of the Hubble parameter, perhaps quoted in units of kilometers per second per megaparsec. Of course, that varies with time, and so the expansion rate is measured by the Hubble parameter at the time or temperature you're interested in. And if you have a non-standard modification of the standard model, the Hubble parameter might be changed. If it's changed due to the presence of extra relativistic particles, more particles contributing to the total energy density during the radiation-dominated stage of the universe when nucleosynthesis occurred, you would increase the Hubble parameter compared to its standard value. And one, by now, conventional way of parameterizing that speed up is through delta N nu, the effective equivalent extra number of neutrinos. So if delta N nu were 1, it would be equivalent to changing the standard radiation density by adding one extra neutrino species. But it doesn't have to be a neutrino. You have some new physics model. In general, you could parameterize it by how much it changes the total radiation density and how much it speeds up the expansion of the universe. But there might be models in which you slow down the expansion of the universe, in which case this delta N nu would be a negative number. And just to set the background, the total number is the standard model 3 plus this delta N nu. Now, as I say, this affects the helium abundance. So what I'm showing you on this figure here, I'll show another version with data on it in a little while, is the BBN prediction for the helium mass fraction going from 20% by mass up to, well, 29% by mass. So very much stretched linear scale for the helium. And the deuterium predicted abundance, not eta, which was on the previous transparency, previous slide, but the predicted deuterium abundance, because you could always eliminate the baryon density and say, for a given deuterium abundance, what do I predict for helium? The violet band is for the standard model 3. You'll notice that it is relatively insensitive to changing the deuterium abundance, provided you don't make dramatic changes in the deuterium abundance. So measure the deuterium abundance to 10%, 15%, 20%, you have a very accurate prediction of what the helium abundance should be. But if the true model for the universe was not the standard model, but one equivalent to fewer than 3 neutrinos, or one equivalent to more than 3 neutrinos, there would be a dramatic change in the predicted helium abundance. Yeah? Deuterium. It's dominated by the uncertainty in deuterium. And they might even be a little bit narrower. This is the result of the code we use at Ohio State. And in recent years, other groups have reanalyzed nuclear physics data, sometimes discarding old data and finding that they could reduce the uncertainties and make these bands maybe half as wide as they seem to be now. So far, as you'll see, we're dominated by the observational uncertainties, but that will be interesting, I think, in the future. I agree with David that deuterium is the baryometer of choice. David has touched on many of these points, so let me go through it quickly. The evolution of deuterium from the Big Bang is the simplest of all the light elements. It's only destroyed when gas is cycled through stars. There is no astrophysical site that makes significant amounts of deuterium without perhaps overproducing something else, like lithium. There are sites where you can make some deuterium, but they often are accompanied by the production of other elements and constraints on their abundance. Remember, lithium is some 5 to 6 orders of magnitude less abundant than deuterium, mean that deuterium is basically only destroyed since the Big Bang. So anywhere, anytime you see deuterium, you know you have a bound on the primordial value. The primordial value can be no smaller than what you observe. And as David said, if you go to a time that's early, and early could mean measured by how metal rich, how enhanced the heavy elements are, so very metal poor compared to the solar metallicity, or to very early on, before the gas has had much time to be cycled through stars, that is at higher redshift, you should see a deuterium plateau. That is, as you go to lower metallicity, higher redshift, you should see the deuterium abundance plateau at a value that is the primordial value. And another reason that deuterium is the baryometer of choice is that it is sensitive to the baryon density. The predicted abundance varies inversely with eta to the 1.6 power. So, for example, a 16% determination of the deuterium abundance leads to a 10% determination of the baryon density. Currently, we're a little bit better than that given the dispersion, and so current deuterium data that David discussed give the baryon density to about 9%, about twice as big as the MAP constraint. And as David explained very clearly, there are potential problems which David has identified and he and his group are looking into in more detail. The spectra of hydrogen and deuterium, neutral hydrogen, neutral deuterium, identical except for the wavelength shift, the isotope shift. And what this means is that among the many problems, you could have neutral hydrogen masquerading as neutral deuterium, or unresolved velocity structure in the hydrogen absorption can lead to your placing the continuum in the wrong place, and therefore lead to systematic errors in your estimate of the total neutral hydrogen column density. But in principle, it's very easy to use deuterium as a baryometer. You measure the deuterium abundance. You use BBN, standard BBN, to predict the variation of deuterium with the baryon density. And you look for the intersection. Now, this is only a cartoon to give you an idea, of course, of what is really done. We don't draw these lines as I've shown, but it's clear then you can then determine the baryon density when the universe was 20 minutes old and nucleosynthesis ended. And then what we're going to do is compare that to the baryon density as inferred from the cosmic background radiation some 380,000 years later.
You're claiming deuterium is better than helium?
For the baryon density, much better. Basically, the helium abundance, Y, delta Y, varies as 0.01 times delta 8 over eta. So to get any significant constraint on delta 8 over eta, you need to know helium very accurately. So here is a plot similar to one that David shown as of just about a month ago, when the latest QSO from David's group was added. So the deuterium abundance is a function of metallicity, a tenth solar hundredth thousandth. Here is the solar system deuterium abundance, a little bit hard to see here. at a little bit less than about 2 parts in 10 to the 5. The interstellar medium, about 1.5 parts in 10 to the 5. And then these 5 QSOs, I agree with David that the 6th one probably shouldn't be used since it's changed by nearly a factor of 2 just because of the discovery of more velocity structure than originally anticipated. The 2 highest ones, as David mentioned, are the ones with the smaller total hydrogen column density, Lyman limit systems. These are the ones that are more susceptible to having a neutral hydrogen masquerading as deuterium. And perhaps they are high because they're somewhat contaminated. The other 3 have higher hydrogen column density, damped Lyman alpha or nearly damped Lyman alpha systems. And well, now 2 of them seem reasonably consistent. The Patini and Bowen point may be subject to error because of the poorer signal to noise, but maybe because they couldn't set the continuum properly. As David showed you, if you take the map results independently and say, that tells me the baryon density, therefore I can predict the deuterium abundance, here is the 1 sigma band. And as David showed, you would worry a bit about these 3 outliers. Nonetheless, also as David emphasized, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we were asking, is the abundance down here or is the abundance way up here? And we now know generally where it is.
Hey, Gary.
Yeah. Well, I think they're probably 2 to 3 sigma away if you believe the sigmas. But as David, I think, emphasized, it's probably the systematics that are more important than the statistical errors. Would you agree with that, David?
It's about 1% of the time. Not good.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, whoops, let me go back. If you were to do a chi-squared on this, it's a bit over 15 for 4 degrees of freedom. You wouldn't be terribly happy with that. Whoops. Okay, so translate this into the baryon density, omega BH squared, and I thought I'd make a little time plot. When David's group, Burleson Teitler, first measured the 2 most reliable ones, there was a precursor period when the Keck first started operating, when people, I think, were learning the pitfalls, and there were many claims of deuterium detections and deuterium abundance determinations which had to be retracted. But the 2 Burleson Teitler QSOs early on were the higher ones. They gave, therefore, a somewhat lower baryon density. And then O'Meara et al., David's group, Patini and Bowen, the value increased to about 21% or so. And here's the current 5 average with the dispersion taken for the error bar. So the red points are the deuterium data plus BBN to infer the baryon density. And the blue point is MAP. From this red data, the observed deuterium abundance 2.6 plus or minus 0.4. Now, I know this is a perceptive audience from some of the comments in the morning talks, and you may have noticed that David had 2.78. This 2.6 is taking the mean of the deuterium abundances D over H. David's 2.78 is from taking the mean of the log of the deuterium abundance and converting. And because the errors are different in the weighting, we get slightly different answers, sort of a half a sigma apart. But for that reason, I'm only quoting the deuterium abundance to the first decimal place rather than the second, because whether you take the average of the abundances or the average of the log of the abundances, you get slightly different answers. In any case, it's not anything worth quibbling about. We get a baryon density that's 0.022 omega BH squared, 022 with about a 9% uncertainty. And the MAP point is, well, it's not just MAP. They added in other things in addition to their own data. They find 0.0224 with about a 4% uncertainty. So at that point, I think this agreement between the baryon density determined by nucleosynthesis when the universe was 20 minutes old and CMB when the universe is 380,000 years old is maybe even better than we might have anticipated. It's spectacular. I'll just say a brief word about helium. Again, thanking David for introducing the topic. The way you observe helium is by recombination lines from ionized helium to neutral helium in hot ionized gas, those are called H2 regions, of low metallicity, extragalactic ones. Here's the oxygen abundance. The solar oxygen abundance, the solar system oxygen abundance, is about 500 on this scale. So somewhere close to maybe the end of the wall. These are the low metallicity extragalactic H2 regions that are used, and you look at recombination lines. The data compilation in red is from the work of Keith Olive and Evan Skillman and myself. We took it from the literature. So it was disparate sources, different telescopes, different detectors. The dispersion was actually quite small. And here are the red points we use. We found an intercept of 0.234 with a statistical uncertainty 3 in the third decimal place. One of the things I want to emphasize is people are often concerned, well, you had to make an extrapolation to zero. On this linear scale, we're very close to zero. If we didn't make the extrapolation, that is, fit a slightly tilted curve rather than a horizontal one, this would change by about 1 or 2 in the third decimal place. So the answer doesn't depend upon saying that I see a linear trend that isn't flat here but slightly rising, and I had to extrapolate. We're very close, in some sense, to what you mean by zero metallicity. The blue points are from Isatov and Tuan, and though it's hard to see on this scale, they all lie slightly higher. And so they find 0.244 with a smaller error bar that's a little bit suspicious for various reasons. But the interesting point is that the difference is much bigger than this estimate of the statistical uncertainty. And so systematic effects must be present. And I'll be glad later to talk about some potential systematic effects. There are some that affect both data sets. For example, since you only see recombination lines, you don't see neutral helium or neutral hydrogen. Maybe there's some neutral helium where the hydrogen is ionized, or vice versa. And then you'd have to make what's called an ionization correction. Various groups have tried to make that correction and found that these data should be reduced by somewhere around 6 or so in the last decimal place. So these might be lower. Other systematic effects have been identified, temperature fluctuations, for example, because some of the helium lines seen can be affected by collisional excitation, so temperature is important. And they also tend to reduce whatever this intercept is. So the systematic effects that have been studied quantitatively go down, but we do know of others that might go up. What Keith Olive, Terry Walker, and I adopted in a review article a couple of years ago was sort of a compromise, but with an inflated uncertainty to account for the fact that statistical uncertainties were too small and likely this was dominated by some systematic effects. Okay, back to the same transparency I showed you earlier, helium versus deuterium. Take the Teitler et al. deuterium abundance determination and this helium abundance that I told you about, the Olive, Steigman, and Walker value, you'll notice that this data point lies much closer to 2 than to 3. That is, in some sense, the standard model may be challenged, modulo the possibility that the helium abundance, not only the uncertainty is too small, but the actual location of the point may be wrong. But let's see what this leads to. If I restrict the range of eta, the baryon density that I cover, it turns out that over those ranges, the abundances change roughly linearly. That is, it's not a bad approximation. Of course, we don't do it this way, but I thought it would be a good way to show the results. In this eta speed-up factor plot, so here's the standard model, one. Here's a slowdown. Here's a speed-up. Here are the deuterium abundances, ISO deuterium abundance curves, 4 parts in 10 to the 5, 3, 2.5, 2.0. The red curves are for the helium abundance, as indicated. And what you see is they're nearly orthogonal to each other. The baryon density is mostly determined by deuterium. The speed-up factor is determined mostly by the helium. And what you can see is that the best fit value is for a slowdown factor, about 0.94 or so, and that one is something like 2 sigma away. So just to show you the numbers, using the most recent deuterium, the helium abundance, what we would infer from this comparison crudely is 0.021 plus or minus 0.02. The speed-up factor is actually a slowdown factor, a little bit surprising, and that corresponds to delta N nu negative, about 0.7, but 2 sigma away from 0, 2 sigma away from the standard model. Now, David mentioned the lithium, and here's a similar plot, lithium versus deuterium. This Big Bang nucleosynthesis band has now errors from the uncertainty in the predicted deuterium and dominated by the uncertainty really in the predicted lithium, so it's a big broad band. Here is this lithium abundance determination that David mentioned. Ryan Beers, Olive's Field, and Norris. And this is what they quote. And clearly this is so many sigma away from the prediction that if you're going to reconcile it, you have to worry about systematic effects. One of them is the fact that these are very old stars where you've seen the lithium. So there's been a lot of time for mischief to have occurred. Mischief such as mixing some of the surface material into the interior and destroying or diluting the lithium. Mark Pinsonneau is an expert on rotating stars, as well as the standard solar model, but rotating stars will also mix material, and so along with Terry Walker and Ramesh Narayanan, we looked at this data set and asked if we could fit it, that is maintaining the small dispersion, but still allow for some depletion. And we can boost this up considerably. And then with our estimate of what the residual uncertainties are, we perhaps can find some overlap. So it is very important to have accurate lithium determinations, and as David mentioned, lithium-6 determinations, because they are even more easily, lithium-6 is more easily destroyed than lithium-7. If the lithium-6 is surviving, that can't be much depletion, and that would move this curve down. But that's where we stand with lithium. Maybe it's too low. Let me show you the same figure that I just showed you a moment ago, the speed-up factor versus eta. This is the curve I just showed a moment ago. Let me superimpose the isolithium contours. Suppose you say I'm going to resolve this apparent discrepancy between helium and deuterium by changing the standard model and allowing for a slower than standard expansion rate. What do I do to lithium? The lithium abundance, well, you can see it more easily here maybe, is about 4 parts in 10 to the 10, a factor of 3 higher than the Ryan et al. Estimate. And you can't change that by allowing for this non-standard value. That is, this range is relatively small and it's high compared to the observations. Okay, I mentioned one possible extension of the standard model, changing the expansion rate. For nucleosynthesis, there's something else you could do. Suppose you had what we called electron neutrino degeneracy. That's just a fancy way of saying I have more electron neutrinos than electron antineutrinos. And if I have more neutrinos than antineutrinos of the electron type, quantified by psi sub e, which is the chemical potential divided by kT, if that's positive, then if you look at the reactions that are turning neutrons into protons and protons into neutrons, you drive the reactions in the sense of having fewer neutrons and more protons. So you decrease the neutron to proton ratio. But it's the neutron to proton ratio that determines the helium abundance and hardly affects at all deuterium, helium-3, or lithium-7. So without damaging the other predictions, you could drive down the predicted helium mass fraction. So again, on a similar kind of plot, a limited range of eta, these linear curves wouldn't be very good fits if I extended it to higher and lower values of eta, but over this range of eta, these linear isoabundance curves are actually very accurate. Here is this parameter psi sub e. So 0 or 10 to the minus 9 would be the asymmetry that we have in the baryon sector. So 0 on this scale. Again, you can reconcile the helium abundance and the deuterium abundance provided you have a non-zero value of psi sub e at a level that's small, but enormous compared to the baryon asymmetry. About 0.04 at 2 sigma less than 0.1. But at 2 sigma also consistent with 0 because this discrepancy between helium and deuterium is really only a 2 sigma discrepancy. And the central value for the baryon density in this case is a little bit higher than it was when we used the speed up factor, 0.022. If we do the full analysis in Big Bang nucleosynthesis, allow the speed up factor or delta N nu to vary along with the baryon density, here in the two-dimensional plane, delta N nu eta are our contours, 68%, 95%, 99%, using the low value for the helium abundance, but with the big error bar. The best fit is at about minus 0.7, as I indicated before. The baryon density is about 0.021. You might imagine the Isatov and Twan data point is closer to what is predicted, so maybe if we use that instead, we could change this conclusion. Well, the best fit point is at about minus 0.3, but since they're error bars in the helium abundance were 2.5 times smaller than what we used in this fit, the curves are flattened. And once again, it's basically a 2 sigma effect. So let's quickly summarize the conclusions from Big Bang nucleosynthesis and then see what happens when we include the new map results. For an assumed primordial abundance extracted from the data and from this value for the helium abundance, in the case where the neutrinos are non-degenerate, we find a baryon density of about 0.021 or eta of about 5.7. Delta N nu is about minus 0.7, 2 sigma away from zero, but the predicted lithium abundance is high. An alternative is to keep set delta nu equal to zero, that is the standard number of three neutrinos, but allow for an electron neutrino degeneracy, asymmetry. The baryon density is essentially the same, a little bit higher. 8 is 6.15, which quite accidentally is almost identically the MAP value. You require Xi e to be about 0.04, but 2 sigma away from zero. And once again, you can't do anything about the lithium abundance. It stays high. Okay, so in the remaining few minutes, what I want to show you without going through the details of the analysis that has just been done very recently, we've taken, and this is Vern and Danny and Haisong Lee, taken the MAP-CMB data, and we've overlaid, well, on this transparency, here is the Olive Steigman Walker helium abundance, so the 0.238 but with the big error bars, 68%, 95% contours. Here's what you get from the CMB. The CMB constrains the baryon density very well, but does very poorly in constraining delta N nu, because there's a degeneracy between increasing the relativistic energy density and increasing the matter density in the universe. And because of that degeneracy, the CMB doesn't do nearly as well vertically, but does better horizontally. But the important point, I think, to emphasize here is the outstanding overlap between the Big Bang contours and the MAP contours. And once again, just to, well, here's what you get if you use Isotov and Twan. Notice that the Big Bang contours are much skinnier in the vertical direction, but again, outstanding overlap between the MAP data and the nucleosynthesis data. Once again, confirming, generally speaking, the outstanding agreement between 20 minutes and 380,000 years in our understanding of the evolution of the universe. And just to show it in a slightly different way, here is the likelihood distributions all normalized to 1 for the Big Bang, so the value of 8 to 10 from Big Bang nucleosynthesis with the low helium abundance, with the Isotov and Twan helium abundance, and with the MAP independent determination of the baryon density. And again, the overlap is excellent. Given that the overlap between these two independent ways of measuring N nu and eta are so good, it makes sense to do a joint analysis. And so I'll show you two versions of this. Here is at least our preliminary results on the joint Big Bang nucleosynthesis, meaning put in deuterium, put in helium, use the Big Bang code to predict the chi-squareds or delta chi-squareds for combinations of delta N nu and eta, and join that with the MAP data. And here are the joint contours, 68%, 95%. The first thing you see is that they have a best fit value at negative delta N nu, but I think the more important conclusion is that at better than 95%, the standard model is not excluded. You reach a... Excuse me?
Is there a punchline here that shows where sterile neutrinos are?
No, sterile neutrinos I'm not going to say anything about. Maybe George will say something later in the week. Oh, I'm almost finished. Instead of the OSW helium abundance, suppose we use the higher helium abundance but with the smaller error bar, we reach the same conclusion. You slightly favor a negative delta N nu, but at better than 95%, you're allowed to live with the standard model. So in fact, I hope I haven't spoken too quickly, or maybe I didn't say enough. I think the conclusions we can reach is that, first of all, independent determinations of N nu and eta from Big Bang nucleosynthesis and from the CMB are consistent, which is strong support for our model of understanding the evolution of the universe during its early stages. And the agreement between the CMB and observations of large-scale structure at later times, the Lyman Alpha Forest, the 2DF and Sloan surveys, provides further evidence that we understand, perhaps, the even later evolution. From this joint analysis, the best value of eta is between 6.1 and 6.2. 6.3 is for the Isitoff and Twan value. If I believe these significant figures, and maybe the second decimal place you should be suspicious of, we're almost bang on the MAP result alone. That's because the MAP data best constrains the baryon density, and it's very accurate. 0.0225 or 0.0230. The best value for N nu for the OSW helium is 2.25. It's much closer for the Isitoff and Twan helium abundance, but when you look at the 95% confidence ranges, so I let you stare at those numbers, but for N nu, the upper bounds are essentially indistinguishable. That's because Isitoff and Twan is low by 2 sigma, and Olive, Steigman, and Walker are low by 2 sigma. So our upper bounds are essentially 3 and almost indistinguishable. The lower bounds are noticeably different. Isitoff and Twan would say you're between 2.5 and 3. We would say you're between 1.8 and 3. And finally, we're going to hear some talks, Nicole Bell, I think, for one, later on, that using the solar and atmospheric neutrino mixing information, it's clear, at least in a three-active neutrino scenario, that the neutrinos would have equilibrated in terms of chemical potential prior to Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So if the electron neutrinos have a chemical potential, so do the mu and tau neutrinos, and they would be the same at this level of about 0.04, 2 sigma from zero. I should comment, and you may have thought about this, this is a very small value in some sense. What do I mean by that? Well, every time you have degenerate neutrinos, it means you have more neutrinos present than in the case of equal numbers of neutrinos and antineutrinos. More neutrinos means more energy density in those relativistic neutrinos. So you might wonder, well, how much will this contribute to the delta N nu? And the answer is that if I have 3 degenerate neutrinos at this level, it's less than 0.01 in delta N nu. And again, you shouldn't take terribly seriously that second decimal place. It certainly can float around by a few units. So this kind of degeneracy is allowed and doesn't affect the expansion rate, therefore won't easily be probed, maybe never be probed by the CMB observations, and would be difficult to be excluded by the Big Bang nucleosynthesis data unless and until the helium abundance moves in a way that we're convinced is reliable. Thank you. Jim.
Gary, could you clarify whether your CMB analysis or any priors assumed on the cosmological parameters, or, and if so, how sensitive are the results?
Well, I believe, and I'll ask Danny to confirm for me, of course we have priors, but we took very big ranges for all the parameters that were varied, but the only one that was restricted was for the Hubble parameter, where we basically took the HST bound of 0.72 plus or minus 0.08, something like that. So that was the only one that was restricted. The others, the baryon density, the matter density, the optical depth, the slope of the spectrum, we covered very large ranges. We ran 600,000 different models.
Can you explain more clearly what the difference is between what your analysis and isotope and quantum? I mean, you're both looking at helium.
Yeah.
How come was it a totally different sample? Or what made it?
No, there was a significant overlap in the sample. Here's what Isotop and Tuan, I mean, first of all, I think I needn't explain to you, but maybe to the others, I haven't ever looked through a telescope, so none of the data is mine. But what we did was we took the data from, Evan Skillman has, but we took the data from the literature. Now, there are several recombination lines that are used for the helium abundance determination, for the helium recombination lines. Some of them are affected by collisional excitation. That is, you have a recombination, the electron cascades down towards the ground state, gets trapped in a metastable state of helium, and before it goes to the ground state, it gets kicked back up by a collision, and therefore cascades down again. So, in fact, for the intensity of certain lines, you're getting more helium than you should really be counting. So you have to know this collisional excitation correction. Most observers try to avoid those lines. Isotop and Tuan try to use them. Now, what happens is sometimes the helium abundance they get from those lines differs from the helium abundance they get from other lines. They take an average. But this could be a systematic effect rather than a statistical effect. And it goes in the sense of giving them a higher abundance than what the other observers would get. So that's one source of the difference, and perhaps the main source of the difference. Another issue is that in fitting a slope to the helium versus oxygen abundance, even though I argued it wasn't terribly significant, Isotop and Tuan have incredibly small errors on their oxygen abundance determinations. They're unrealistically small. It's hard to determine the oxygen abundance. Oxygen is a coolant. So you put more oxygen into an H2 region, you make it cooler, you make the oxygen lines weaker, but it's not because there's less oxygen, it's because the region is cooler. So it's very hard to actually determine the oxygen abundance as accurately as they claim. But with tiny errors in the oxygen abundance, they get tiny errors in their slope, and their slope is a little bit flatter than the one that we found. So that has some contribution. Now, it's true what David said. There's been almost no change in this subject for the last maybe 10 years. Except for the work of Manuel Painbert, his family and friends. In Mexico, they don't use the telescopes in Mexico, but they have reobserved several of the Isotop and Tuan H2 regions, half a dozen of them, I think, and reanalyzed them. And they get systematically lower helium abundances by 7 in the third decimal place, 007. For reasons they believe that they have evidence that there are temperature fluctuations, so these collisional effects are different from what Isotop and Tuan calculate. So they haven't accumulated as much data as currently exists, but from the few sort of test cases they've done, they've suggested that at least the error is larger than what Isotop and Tuan claim.
Last year, I have seen numbers on mu, something like 3.3 and slightly
Okay. Well, yes and no. I mean, because you'll notice in this analysis, we put no prior on n nu. We allowed it to be less than 3. Some of the higher numbers that I think you're remembering, you put a prior that n nu has to be 3 or bigger. Well, clearly, if you do that, you're going to get a weaker upper bound than what I'm quoting here. So I think the main difference is what kind of prior you put on N nu, and we're going to add that to our analysis and see how much it changes.
Okay, we really should.